Okay. Good evening, everybody. I am very happy to introduce a good friend of ours, a good Dharma friend, a practitioner, and a fellow astrologer, and a really good friend, Joseph Crane, who is really a wonderful, delightful person to have in our presence, and I'm sure will actually satisfy many of our deepest longings to hear new Dharma.
Well, this is delightful. I don't know anybody here except for these three are surrounding me. So I'm happy to meet you all. I'm delighted there's so many people here. This is wonderful. I'm glad we're not meeting on Saturday night or Sunday. And I'm certainly you weren't at the, you were not wearing that t-shirt on Saturday. Most likely. So, I also realized at some point yesterday that I gave the same talk in Waltham when I was 28.
No.
See, yes.
At Brandeis?
No, at Fertile School.
No.
They had a staff development kind of like everybody, a potpourri of people bring in their favorite topics and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I talked about the development of ego. Mm-hmm. I was like 27. It's like, wow. What was I thinking? So hopefully I'll give a better talk.
Well, you're not the same person.
I am not the same person. But importantly, I'm not the same person, but the memory is there. The state of mind is there. I know where how to get to Fernald from here. Okay? I can make this into a big deal. That's the point of this hour we're going to spend together. So we're going to talk about the skandhas. And most of this I am taking from the development of ego talk that's on the website. It's from Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. And there are a couple ways of looking at it. But I want to start with the basic general question. And this is having heard from Emily what you folks have been doing for the past couple weeks and listening to some of the talks. And it's all been very good on sort of deconstructing what we think of as me. The question then comes, really obviously, why do we persist in the solidification, in this creating a frozen self and a frozen world? Why don't we just, like, do space? Well, there are a lot of ways, right? I mean, you think about it. We could do space. We could make it really simple. But no, we have these tentacles of ego that just are all-encompassing and self-suffocating. So why do we do this? Now, there's sort of a scientific answer that we're living beings. We persist in our being. We do. Every living being does that. We are no different. However, as humans, we have an incredible bureaucracy to maintain this and to get confused by it. We actually think that the bureaucracy is who we are, is a bureaucracy. And we know, from those of you who work in bureaucracies, they're pretty fragile. And they're kind of held together mostly by duct tape. And ego is like that too. We're sort of held together by duct tape. And not the good stuff, the stuff that peels off really easily. That's called meditation. So, five skandhas. Now, you can read all about this in intro Buddhist books. They're sometimes called aggregates. The word skandha sort of means a pile. And the idea is that these are not interconnected systems, but they're heaps of stuff. And these stuff, they sort of like bill around a lot all the time. And they bill around so fast that we actually think it's a solid self. And so that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to construct, what did we call this? Constructing the imaginary self.
Imputed.
The imputed self. I started with imaginary. But
imaginary works too. Imputed is nice. That comes from that. We like.
It sounds more dharmic than imaginary. And by the way, I can keep talking, so please feel free to like burst in anytime you'd like. Especially since I don't know you, and I'm very curious what you're like. So Trungpa Rinpoche, in Cutting Through, uses the analogy of the monkey in a house. A house with like five windows, each representing a sense perception. And the idea is the monkey could be doing the monkey's version of space, which is like being out in the jungle and cavorting and eating bananas and finding friends and stuff like that. But instead, the monkey is in this house, this solid house. And you can sort of see out, but you can't do very much. And that is a beginning of the birth of ignorance or the skanda of form. And, we just read in the Heart Sutra, form is emptiness, emptiness is also form. This is what we're going to do. We're going to start with form. And form is basically what we think of, one way of saying it, is the external world. Mm-hmm. Is the fact that, this room has a certain shape. You have a certain form. My car has a certain form. I'm going to go to my house, it has a certain form. It's some sort of objective reality. And unfortunately for us, that supposition of objective reality is called the birth of ignorance. Because it is based on this. It is not based on that. That would be fine. If you were enlightened, there'd be that. The problem is there is this. And actually, it's the only word that Trungpa Rinpoche capitalizes. He doesn't capitalize but, he capitalizes that, THAT. Sort of things as they are. But we muck it up. And we do it in a couple ways. And there are three steps. The first step is called the birth of ignorance. And he talks about a little grain of sand on the beach saying, here I am, here I am. And it's like a little bit of a, it's kind of like the first hiccup before the Big Bang. It's just a little tweak of self. You couldn't even call it primitive. It's sort of primordial. But it's a little tweak that makes all the difference. Because it begins to establish a me and a world. But it has to begin somewhere. It begins slowly, imperceptibly. Then there's called the ignorance arising, co-arising. Sometimes called co-emergent in the fancy books. And that's, we've sort of established this rudimentary me and other thing. And it's a little bit embarrassing. We get a little awkward. It's a little self-conscious. We all know what it's like to all of a sudden we're doing stuff and all of a sudden we feel self-conscious. It's like, Well, that's that moment. And that moment happens a lot. Those who really work with their mind can see it happening all the time. And if you've looked at the three kinds of suffering, there's all pervasive suffering. I think that's related to that. It's this like this continual sense of lack, this continual sense of wanting something to keep us company. We don't know what, but it's awkward and it feels funny. Out of that feeling funny, we get the self-conscious ego, or the ignorance of self-consciousness. You can look up the words. I forget. I didn't take my notes here. And we all know what that's like. I was thinking how interesting. The word ego is a fairly new word. Usually Buddhists talk about attachment. And Freud has this wonderful definition of ego. It's like that which actually looks at itself and thinks of it as separate from itself, but who's looking at it? Now, Freud had a pretty Buddhist moment at that point, because that's exactly what's meant by this ego of self-consciousness. All of a sudden, we become a thing. And we know that that is part of us. We know that we can do that all the time, and we know that there's trouble there. Okay, let me shut up. Anyone have anything they'd like to throw into the conversation? Please, what's your name?
Elise.
Elise?
So I was telling, I meet with Erica to talk about stuff, and I was saying when I read the thing about the monkey being in the house and not being out, I suddenly saw what like space and emptiness was. And I've been reading, we've been talking about it, and I was like, cool. I smiled and nodded when we talked about it.
We all do.
And then I was like, oh, wait, you could just go wherever you want. And that sense of, you know, when we talked about, like, I'm not the kind of person who, that's what that house is. Like, I'm in my house. This is what I do. I don't go out and just do whatever. Like, I don't go in any direction because I'm here. I can only do this.
Right.
And that sense of, if you're in the middle of the jungle, where do you want to go?
It's not a mobile home. We can't go anywhere. And I think we experience this a lot just doing meditation practice. So we sort of plant ourselves, and all of a sudden we feel very thick. And the environment feels very thick, even if we're surrounded by other people. And we've kind of forgotten that there's a whole kind of spatial thing going on around us. Because, you know, we're in our posture and it's just very, well, it's very thick. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. So the monkey, according to Trungpa Rinpoche, has been sort of like bouncing around and getting fascinated and then getting irritated and getting bored. I think we all know this routine. And begins to slow down a little bit and begins to sort of feel his or her way around the cage. And the second skanda is called feeling. And that is generally presented, first of all, it's universal. We're doing it constantly, all the time. It's binary. It's automatic. It's I like, I don't like. More primitively than that. You can call it like a positive or a negative valence. Going on all the time. It's very stupid. But it's very necessary because we're establishing a beginning of a relationship to a world. We're beginning to set up ego strategy. And we do it first by feeling. There's not much to say about it. But interestingly enough, you know, the five skandhas are also attached to five wisdoms, or five Buddha families. And you can read about that in the last chapter of Cutting Through. And the Buddha family and the wisdom attached to the second skanda of feeling is called the wisdom of equanimity. And it's what we do, and if we practice a lot, we can do it more easily. Maybe, you know, we have a little bit of that Friday or Saturday, that, you know, pleasure, pain, whatever. There's positive, there's negative valence. That tuna sandwich wasn't very good. I didn't like it. So what? And we can have a certain kind of, I'll call it detachment, at the same time that we're experiencing this positive-negative polarity. And we're doing it constantly. However, as you can tell, even that's a bit gappy. You need something a little more sophisticated because space might creep in there anyway, and we can't have that. That's too scary. We have to continue, and part of the game of ego, or the con job of ego, or the cover-up of ego, is that we're constantly needing to get more and more sophisticated stuff to keep the networks have to get more and more sophisticated because we're afraid a little sunlight might come in, and that's too scary. So in addition to Sometimes it's used temporally, but in addition to feeling, there is the third skanda called perception impulse. And that confused me for a while. It's like, what? Well, what is that? Well, perception is, it's going to be more sophisticated. It has gradients. It's not just I like, I don't like, or positive, negative. It's I like this more than that. I can see differences in things. One person has a t-shirt, the other person next to him has a jacket, the woman has a red sweater, or red sweater? Green sweater. So we're able to make distinctions. We're able to see some lines in things. And a lot of our responses, and that's the impulse part, is going to be based on these discriminating perceptions. And so you put feeling and perception together, and you have our three basic attitudes toward phenomena. Approach, sometimes called passion, I like it, I want to get closer. Avoidance, I don't like it, I want to destroy it, I want to get away from it. Or, I don't care. So we do passion, aggression, ignorance, you could call it. But even that sounds a little sophisticated. We could call it just approach, avoidance, ignoring. And many of our assessments are based on that. I was thinking on my way here how when my wife and I watch a movie together or go to a restaurant, she's continually modulating her sense of like, dislike. Well, this movie was okay, but the one, you know, last week the one we saw was better. And maybe the sequel is better than this, but this wasn't very good. It was all right, but it didn't really send me. And I like Indian, it's too spicy for me. Okay? We do that, perception. It's a bit on the naive side, but we're constantly drawing lines, expressing degrees of favorability, unfavorability. It's sort of, it's automatic, it's kind of dumb. But, you know, we do it all the time. You know, the traffic here was not fun, but, hey, I'm glad it's not snowing, it's just raining. So, now what we've done is we set up the basic scaffolding, the foundation. You could say the foundation is form, and the big beams are feeling and perception. And these happen so quickly, so instinctively, that, you know, this is coming over and over again, almost, it's too fast to recognize some of the time. Sometimes when our minds get really slow, when we're in a very relaxed place, or maybe we're in the presence of a teacher and there's something very radiant and sort of a big mirror at us, we can actually see a bit of the feeling mechanism, the perception mechanism. It's hard. However, the next one is justly the most famous. We do this all the time. It's easy to talk about. And that's the fourth one. Sometimes it's called intellect, but that's a lousy word for it. Sometimes it's called concept. Most of the time we call it, quote, formation, which we're giving form. We're making form to something. And the Sanskrit is samskara. And this is where they love to throw lists at you. Like sometimes there are 49 or 50 or 52 or 51. And I think everyone who has really tried to learn Buddhist psychology has really sort of memorized the samskaras, and then 36 hours later they've forgotten them. Because the list is not a big deal. What are the samskaras? They are, we could call them states of mind. States of mind that we all know very well. Some of them are called virtuous states of mind. And those tend toward the mind opening up. But we can get fixated on those too. Sometimes they're non-virtuous states of mind, which tend to cause us and others unhappiness. So, I was thinking of an example. Some years ago, I was in the middle of some political type situation. And I was very angry at some people. I was really, really angry. And I don't do anger very often, but when I do, it makes headlines. At least in my mind. Fortunately, just in my mind. But, you know, as usual, I do my Buddhist practice every morning. And what happens is these angry thoughts well up as energy, as object, as storyline. And you do this sort of day after day, and you notice stuff. And the first thing you notice is it's never the same twice. You have the word angry, but, you know, you can't do anger the same way. It always changes. Your mind is always doing different things. Secondly, there, where do they come from? Where does the anger come from? There's a little thought arises. Now, all of a sudden, the train is rolling down the track. And it's going to be a different train, it's a different track, but it sort of has the same label of being angry. But then what happens is you realize a few minutes later that your mind went somewhere else. A little anger comes up, and then something else happens. I don't know what, I'm hungry for breakfast, or, you know, I should have gone to the bathroom before I started practicing, and now I don't want to get up, what am I going to do? Whatever, you know what mind does. And then I realized that there was no such thing as anger. There were angry thoughts. There was this weaving and unweaving. I was sort of like Penelope every night. You know, weaving the wedding garment and then unweaving it the next day. I was doing that with a state of mind. And I can do that with any state of mind. Including the virtuous stuff. I can well up with all kinds of inspiration and renunciation, stuff like that. It starts somewhere, the train goes down the track, and there are these thoughts. They're just made up of heaps. They're bundles. They're not connected. Then they go away. Then they come back. So, in some sense, yes, Joe Crane had a problem with anger. On the other hand, the whole thing I was making up. The whole thing isn't real. Now, what does that do? First of all, it's hard to take yourself so damn seriously. You get a little bit of space creeps in there. Not much. But the whole thing becomes soft, becomes more atmospheric. It's like, okay, I'm doing this atmosphere of anger. Or passion, or, you know, you can go through all that. So, the samskaras are multitudinous. I don't think they're ever meant to be a complete list. You can look through all 51, you'll find stuff that happens in your mind all the time that's, you know, not in the list of samskaras, that's fine. But they're made to give you, this is a group of how we label our experience. And some of them, like faith and aspiration, is good labeling. Conscientiousness. Some of them is like, you know, spite, resentment, you know, those are like, you know, bad samskaras. But none of them is solid. They all come and go. They're made up of these little thoughts that just sort of pile on top of each other. They're heaps. So that was kind of liberating. Not that I don't get angry. But it's hard to get angry and take it so damn seriously. And it's sort of like, okay, this is the channel I'm on. You know, I'm watching a Donald Trump press conference. Okay. This will soon be over, and I'll change the channel to something else. I think I'll do Animal Planet after this. Or maybe there's some nice British baking show or something like that. So I think I'll do British baking show for a while. I'll feel better. Or check out Netflix. But that you know, like, and that almost becomes, which samskara do you want to indulge in? Do you want to indulge in the, you know, action adventure? Do you want to indulge in the comedy? Do you want to indulge in the romance? And so, in a lot of ways, the fourth skanda is the easiest for us to recognize and work with. Because it's conscious, it's with us all the time. All we have to do, in a way, is to sort of lean back and figure out what we're feeling. And there's usually a word for that. And we find out that what we're feeling has a lot of subtlety and a lot of complexity. And when you try to really figure out what it is and where it's at, it kind of scoots away. So, that's samskara. Now, you got to have something to say. Please.
So I've found that my practice with deep tissue massage, receiving, is really interesting because I'm willingly participating in something that's pretty excruciating.
Yes, yes.
And I find it interesting that I'm there receiving this pain willingly and therefore viewing it as a good thing, mm-hmm. versus being injured or something, you know, negative.
Right.
And I don't know if that's in around the second skanda.
That's very good.
There is the same, you know, a reflex of, wow, this really hurts. And by the way, it's also, it has to do with expectations, because if it doesn't hurt enough, it's not that good.
You would have to change the channel on the samskara skanda.
That's right.
To get out and say, I'm not doing the same one, this is terrible.
Right.
And you can, actually, that's a good example. I'm a runner. So I'm good at pain. I can do like, okay, this must be good for me because it really hurts. Where do they say that pain is, let's say in the Marines, like pain is
weakness leaving the body.
Weakness leaving the body.
Whoa.
If that's not an invitation to hurt yourself. But that's a good example. You can see the second, third, and fourth skandhas right there.
Right there. Mm-hmm.
The second skandha is the blank pleasure pain. Mm-hmm. The third is, okay, this could be worse, it could be better, it has a texture to it, it has a relative thing. It's only for 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. 10, 20 minutes, I'm going to feel... And then you get to the fourth skanda.
Right.
It's like, gratitude. What a great opportunity for me to have a much improved body and functionality. Because of this deep tissue massage. I think you're nuts, but
okay. I do too.
Most people look at me running, you know, half marathons, think I'm a kind of kooky as well.
Yeah.
But
haunted houses are the same thing.
I'm sorry?
Haunted houses are the same thing. We go into a haunted house wanting to be scared out of our
minds. That's right. Mm-hmm.
And yet,
right.
If we go through life and something like that happens in real life, it freaks us out.
Absolutely.
In a negative way.
That's right.
One's pleasurable, the other is not.
One has play to it. Mm. Actually, Freud talked about that too, in terms of overcoming, it's a way of working with fear, overcoming fear.
Well, you have control over a haunted house, you know it's not real. I mean, that's why people wake. playing with.
And they like these movies. Emily and I were talking some weeks ago about how we both really loathe scary movies. And maybe we should like get better at enjoying scary movies because, you know, like life is scary and we're going to die and dying is scary and stuff like that. And I still don't like them.
Yeah, you were talking about the samskaras sort of, if you look at them, you see that they're sort of, you know, not as solid as you think. I've had the opposite experience, which was as illuminating, of having, sitting down to meditate while being mildly irritated at something that had happened that day. And when I got up from meditation, I discovered I'm still irritated, but I'm now irritated at my ex-husband for something that he did approximately 25 years ago. I had the solidity of the emotion, but it didn't really matter what the story was, and I had fixated on something fairly trivial from 25 years ago.
Yes. And isn't mine wonderful? It held on to that for 25 years.
Yeah, it was fascinating because it wasn't like the final fight or anything.
Of course.
It was just this thing that happened to pop, bubble to the surface, and it was sitting there to be looked at.
And you probably, at the time, it probably wasn't a big deal, or you were distracted. And I think that's a natural process of the mind loosening up and becoming more available to itself. It's, you know, it's a specific memory. It has a samskaric feel to it. It's like a state of mind.
Yeah, and it felt like it just sort of popped into the slot after the thing I was irritated about that day kind of dissipated.
Now it's interesting that there is a wisdom that goes along with samskara. It's the wisdom of all accomplishing action. And the reason is that it's efficient. It allows us to understand our mind and our world and to construct something plausible. The problem is that we use our states of mind to create a life history, a diary of resentment, a sense of the world owing us something because it's treated us so badly and the world owes us an apology, or whatever it is. You can see how we have ego can become more and more problematic as we invest ourselves and sort of glue together the samskaras and the other skandhas into a storyline, into a record of resentment, or whatever it happens to be. And, you know, I'm a big fan of understanding one's life. And at the same time, your sort of memory from 25 years ago is part of the texture of your life, and you can't pretend it's not there, say, oh, it's empty of nature, blah, blah, blah. It has significance. At the same time, it's also mind fluttering. That we can take a larger, more spacious view that accommodates that, that doesn't pretend it's not there or makes it into a life story. You know, and, you know, we also know that the virtuous states of mind, when we make those into a life story, we become really attached to them, we identify with them, it begins to stink. It begins to, it's like, you know, the house guests are the fish after 3 days. So, you know, we take pride in our renunciation and our austerity, and we become a complete pain in the ass to our family because we're sort of becoming superior in some ways, or our intellect. And we're really good at We're really good at helping people. Sometimes people don't want to be helped. Sometimes this becomes all about us. And so we all should cultivate the virtuous samskaras, and you can read them, you know, conscientiousness, non-aggression, faith, aspiration. That's fine. And we need to have a sense of humor about them as well. Because as soon as they become like this part of me, it begins to be like fish after 3 days.
But it's that little box we put ourselves in.
Yes.
The monkey. I'm the person who's been wrong. I'm the person who helps people.
Right.
I'm the person who doesn't do all these bad things, unlike the rest of you assholes. I'm so virtuous.
You think those thoughts too.
There's a heuristic I heard recently from Ken McLeod that I really like. Which he says if the story you are telling yourself, if you're either the hero or the victim, it's probably wrong.
Yes.
we very rarely tell stories where we're just a minor character.
Naturally. That's a very good suggestion. If you're going to tell a story, put yourself in a minor role. You can be Guildenstern.
Yeah.
I forget when, but I read, I don't know, not that long ago. I think it might have been in one of those Globe Connections, mm-hmm. you know, in the Sunday Globe. And it was something about having kids growing up, mm-hmm. and that suddenly that you become part of their story rather than them just being your story.
Oh.
It's not that simple. I mean, they still are part of your story, and you're part of their story, but then just put yourself in the minor role, which is letting go of their role, and you're going to die and all that.
I think part of the heartbreak of being a parent is you become a supporting actor.
From day one.
And you think it's going to get better at some point, and it never does.
The other thing I keep thinking of, and Maggie, you're the actress, so I think Shakespeare, nothing is but thinking makes it so. I think that maybe, or something to that. And that's, you lived a long time ago.
Yep.
Even older, so. Yeah.
There's more to say, but this is a good place to see where people are. Anything surprising anything you disagree about or doesn't make sense or is confusing or your experience is different?
Well, you talked about the story being the same every day when you were meditating, or
no, the story, the story,
not the story, but something that would come up similar. It was the same track.
It was the same track, but you know, the scenery was always a little different. You know, it's like, you know, you move by a piece of music and you say, "Oh, that was great! I'll play it again," and it's like never the same.
Right.
You see a movie once, and the second time you see it is a different experience.
Yeah.
However, there's a problem holding this together.
Yeah.
Even with all these samskaras, whether there are 51 or 84 of them, there's another list of 80 thoughts, which are sort of like samskaras in a different context. So this thing is pretty open-ended. That you're not always in a state of mind. Right? You were meditating before. You know, you weren't always saying, well, I'm feeling awkward, I'm feeling uncomfortable, I'm feeling desirous, I'm feeling, you know, angry, I'm feeling hungry. We don't do that. There's sometimes which there's not a whole lot happening. We think there's not a whole lot happening. Then we actually sit down and notice what our mind is doing. There's a whole lot happening. And it's mostly really not very interesting. You know? When you go on retreat, it becomes ridiculous how you can spend an hour thinking about frying an egg.
Supporting actors.
That's right. And so we mind has to have stuff to keep it occupied all the time, even when there's nothing happening. And that brings up the fifth skanda called consciousness. And I think, Emily, you're going to talk about consciousness next time, right?
I think so, but you can go ahead and introduce the topic. Yes. Keep going. Maybe if you talk about it, we won't have to.
Oh, I don't know.
You can stay late.
The word consciousness is vijnana. Okay, the important thing is the V-I prefix. It's like the word by, from, you know, Indo-European. It means to. So consciousness has self and other. It's aware of itself. That's consciousness. It's as simple as that. There are eight kinds. There are the consciousnesses associated with the senses, five of them. There's this funny sixth one. You know, they say, like, no dharmas, no... in the Heart Sutra. Well, that's our consciousness of our thought. Whatever our mind happens to be spinning at any particular moment. Then there is our primordial consciousnesses, which are there sort of in the background, kind of like doing the puppeteer thing. And the seventh is called the klesha. We'll call it the klesha consciousness. It's that part that strings together a self. And the eighth is more primordial, and that's called the storehouse or alaya consciousness. See, you don't have to do it next week.
Keep going. Maybe you have to define klesha because there are new.
Oh, klesha. Oh, passion, aggression, ignorance, pride. That sort of thing. You know, the big headline states of mind that get us in trouble. They're called kleshas.
Afflictive emotions.
Afflictive emotions, or, yeah. You know, we do them like three times a minute.
Second. What? Second.
That's because you have refined your sense of your mind,
oh,
so you see more clearly.
You make everything so positive. That's why I invite you.
That just reminds me of something we learned at the retreat, which is that there are 84,000 types of afflictive emotions. And the teacher said that we won't probably get through all of them today.
Precisely.
Here's the question.
So six is watching your own thoughts. And eight is the primordial, sort of the sympathetic system. The seventh, stringing yourself together.
The seventh comes out of the eighth. The eighth is, Michael, by the way, Michael Fagan, can do this big song and dance about the eighth consciousness.
Oh.
Okay? He's the resident expert. That's called the Alaya Vijnana, or the storehouse consciousness. So I'm going to just say a little tiny bit. It's that part which carries our karma. It's that we could call it in the West unconscious. It sort of has the seeds of all kinds of things that we do. It is neutral, fundamentally, but it's still a basis of consciousness. It's still, it's the puppeteer. Okay? From the puppeteer, we get the afflictive mind, which is the seventh consciousness. And that's the real workman of these skandhas, in a sense. They work over time to keep spinning our sense of identity, our sense of solidity, our sense of me-ness. That's the afflictive or seventh consciousness. And for someone who's enlightened, it kind of becomes jettisoned. It's sort of like, you know, it's the one of those on a spaceship, you know, you jettison the back of the thing that gets you up. That's what you do with the seventh consciousness. But we're mostly there's a weaving that's going on all the time. For our purposes, though, consciousness is that which pretends there's a continuity in our experience because there's always something happening. All of you today probably had this experience this evening saying, well, I've run out of thoughts. How much time do we have left? Okay? We are constantly trying to keep company with ourselves. We're constantly looking for other. And when we run out of thoughts and there's nothing to do, it's scary. That is also where the action is. But we have to get used to that. We have to sort of desensitize ourselves to existing in that kind of space. And the Buddhist path allows us to do that in a very systematic, step-by-step way. So we tolerate more and more openness and more space. And the thing that we do is we start by sitting and noticing this whirlwind universe of our mind and how it seems to be hung, it seems to be so complicated and so sophisticated and so well hung together. We realize it's sort of not. It's kind of all over the place. It's sort of a scattershot kind of thing. And I thought I was like, this whole thing was real, and it kind of isn't. That's where we start.
Mm-hmm. Kenny, it's good to have this talk again about the skandhas, because when was it first introduced to us as a group? A year and a half ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, you know, I always say this, I fought it.
Everybody did.
Okay. It's funny. Really, it sounds like fun.
Oh, no, it's a part of, it's there. Anyway, and the heaps part, when you're talking about tonight, I was thinking about it, this fleeting notion of self. When I was just doing something, having a thought that I thought, oh, that's who I forgot, this is who I am. And then it was a bad thought. It was like, oh, I'm that person who never da-da-da-da.
Uh-huh.
And then I thought, wait a minute, last week I had this thought that I'm that person who always da-da-da-da. And then they are heaps. They aren't connected.
No,
they are just not connected. And I realized that the other day when I thought, I'm this person who does that. It's not, they're not connected. It's just whatever I happen to, whatever comes on strong in my mind during the day, I seem to want to make it solid. Okay, this settles it. This is who I am.
No.
And then you, it's just.
I want to talk about something here, which is getting older.
Oh, thanks.
We invite you back.
That's called a quasia.
So yiddish to me.
Here's what I'm thinking. I was actually talking about
just
myself.
Just wait.
Yeah. I was just saying, I'm thinking about myself.
Older than he looks. Yes.
I have more hair than Michael Fagan, but a lot more hair than the last time I did this talk in London. A lot less hair than when I did this talk in London. Sometimes I think that my high spiritual aspiration is not to become an old fart. And guys are particularly subject to becoming old farts. Because what do we do? Women, I think, become a little more forgetful and a little more spacey in some ways. But men get rigid.
Uh-huh.
They get difficult. And they have a...
Are you generalizing or anything?
No. There's actually been studies about this in terms of what parts of the brain begin to get compromised. You know, it's the frontal area for men. Okay? And so what that means is, I see myself all the time going through, wait, I don't do that. I do this. I'm like that. I'm not like this. I don't like to learn new things. And you know, you don't like to learn new things. And so you sort of close yourself off a little bit. And then there's like your experience, which is, I don't have to do that. And they kind of cohere a little bit. There's this tendency to kind of retreat, and at the same time, I've been practicing too long not to know better than to continually label, this is what Joe Crane does and this is what he doesn't do, and you know, I don't like this kind of music and I do like this kind of opera and all that crap. So it's very interesting when we begin to question ourselves. In some ways the stakes are high, because we can become an old fart if we don't watch out.
And we that's what an ego is, an old fart.
Yeah.
That's a bumper sticker.
I know some people are on farts.
My ego is an old fart. You could cause some accidents.
I think this is why travel is so stimulating, because we define ourselves by our habits.
That's right.
Oh, that's
and when you travel, it's a different situation, different people.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's almost good to go to a place where you don't know the language and you don't know the culture.
Yeah.
And you have to improvise and you have to figure things out. Kids, I think every kid should travel to a foreign country. Mm-hmm. Just to go through the experience of that kind of uncertainty.
Well, every kid does, but they're so little they don't have words for it.
Yeah.
Like you watch a 1 or 2 year old.
Yeah. Sometimes first day of school is like traveling to a foreign country when you're like 4 or 5. Who are these people? What do they do? What am I supposed to do here? Okay.
In hospice work also, there's a lot of emphasis on being where your patient is. So wherever they are.
Mm-hmm.
So if they think that you are their long-lost relative,
mm-hmm.
you don't want to feed the story, but you don't want to reject it. So you want to be where they are with it.
Yeah.
And it's a constant practice when you're with a patient over and over again, trying to let go of your own likes or dislikes about what's going on and be where they are.
And let them have their state of mind.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And their ego constructing a reality. Because it will eventually fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since you're not their long-lost relative.
Right.
This is actually very helpful in terms of working with people. As we work with ourselves, we see the gaps in ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We don't take other people and their minds as solid either.
Right.
It's lovely. People can change like we do. Okay, I have. It's 8:59. I have to be punctual.
Yeah.
Let's see. Do I have any concluding things to say? Not particularly. Let's see.
Why do we string everything together?
Because it's really scary to be by ourselves. It's really scary to be without something to relate to. And much of our fear of death may have to do with that. Because when we die, we lose our phenomena. We lose our identity. We have, according to the Tibetan Buddhist teachings, this is an opportunity to enter vast space. But most of us don't feel that way at all. And the dying process is a process of the entire mechanism of the skandhas breaking down. And where that leaves us is up to us now.